Hi, I'm Simon Campbell.
And I'm Susie Starlight of the Starlight Campbell Band.
Welcome to the Supertone Show.
I thought love was only true in fairy tales. And for someone else, but not for me. Our love was out to get me. That's the way it seemed. Disappointment haunted all my dreams. Then I saw her face. Now I'm a believer. Not a trace of doubt in my mind. I'm in love. I'm a believer. I couldn't leave her if I tried. I thought love was more or less a given. I got. What's the use in trying? And all you get is pain. When I needed sunshine, I got rain. Oh, then I saw her face. Now I'm a believer. Not a trace of doubt in my mind. Then I saw her face. Now I'm a believer. Not a trace of doubt in my mind. I'm in love. I'm a believer. I couldn't leave her if I tried. Yes, I saw her face. Now I'm a believer.
The Monkees, I'm a Believer, released as a single on the 12th of November in 1966 on the Cold Gems record label.
I've been a monkey, sorry.
I know. It was number one for 7 weeks in the Billboard Hot 100 charts and was the biggest selling record, would you believe, in 1967.
No.
Yeah, and it was the Monkees' second single after Last Train to Clarksville, and it was released during the first season of their really famous TV show. But they had over a million pre-orders, you know, and it went gold within 2 days, which means they sold, like, I think it was like 500,000 copies within 2 days. Anyway, they had a million, so that's why they sold that. And overall, they've sold 10 million physical copies worldwide of that song, and it was produced by a chap called Jeff Barry.
And, the Monkees didn't play on this at all.
They didn't, no, they just sang.
That's right. Al Gorgoni, who played The Sound of Silence with the old Simon Garfunkel.
Yeah.
And later on, Brown Eyed Girl, Van Morrison.
With Van, the man.
Yeah. So he played guitar on here, and there was Russ Savakus on bass, George Butcher on piano, Stan Free on Vox Continental organ. And that's it. And that, actually, the whole sound is pretty horrible, really. But it's perfect, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, yeah.
But less of that, and more of, who was it written by?
Go on.
Neil Diamond.
Diamond.
And that is what this show's all about, because we were listening the other day, believe it or not, to some Neil Diamond, and all of a sudden I thought, this guy is really actually very cool. He's written an awful lot of incredibly cool songs that have been covered by some very cool people, and he's a magnificent songwriter. And this show is all about bringing to the attention, isn't it, of people and talking about people that people don't think are cool. But I've got to tell you, the Starlight Campbell Band, Susie Starlight, Simon Campbell, think Neil Diamond is cool.
He's double cool. I've spent the whole day, by the way, in Neil Diamond mode. And it's been the greatest pleasure.
Wow.
And I've enjoyed so much. And you went off for a walk with the girls earlier. And I just said, I don't get a sense of him yet. So I had to stay behind and watch some video interviews with him, because until I could get a sense of his heartbeat, I actually didn't feel that we were ready to do the show. Mm. And then I play some bass. And now I'm happy. We've got some tea and some water. And we're here with Neil Diamond. How cool is that? So should we start at the very beginning?
Yes.
Okay. Neil Leslie Diamond.
Ah.
Born in the Coney Island section of Brooklyn, New York City, on January the 24th in 1941.
Right.
His father, Akiba Kiev Diamond, was a dry goods merchant, and both he and his wife, Rose, were Jewish immigrants from Poland.
Now, you wouldn't have thought Diamond was his real name. I thought he changed it, but that's obviously his real name.
Do you know what? On interviews, people ask him the same question.
Yeah.
It's fascinating, but he just answers and says, yeah, we've got a lot of diamonds, you know, in our family.
Well, yeah, it's and true. I bet, though, when they came from Poland, I bet they changed the name, because Polish names are fiendishly difficult to pronounce. We come across a few over here, don't we?
Yeah. Really.
But anyway, sorry, carry on.
So during World War II, the family temporarily relocated to Cheyenne in Wyoming because of his father's military service. And this is where Neil fell in love, would you believe, with singing cowboy movies at the cinema. He used to go to the matinees. And I know what he's about, but, you know, I know what he means by that, actually.
Yeah.
So after the war ended, the family returned to Brooklyn, and Neil was given a $9 acoustic guitar for his birthday, which kicked off his interest in music, and he started taking guitar lessons and singing lessons. I think he had one singing lesson, actually. Mm. Age 16, I think the one singing lesson was, no, I don't want that. That just ruins the sound of my voice. And he wrote his first song, though, before that, age 15, called Hear Them Bells.
Wow.
So he sang in a 100-member fixed chorus at Brooklyn's Erasmus Hall High School with classmate Barbara Streisand.
No.
Oh, yeah, right? But they didn't actually know each other then. They met years later, but they were in the same... It was a 100-piece choir. He said he didn't know that many people.
That is isn't that incredible?
Yeah.
Wow.
Long shot, that one. So he started a duo singing group called Neil and Jack, and he sang at Long Island's Little Neck Country Club. And then he recorded a single for Shell Records, but the record didn't sell, and, you know, they soon broke up. But then in 1958, Neil entered New York University's pre-med program to become a doctor. He was a very prominent fencer, would you believe, and he got in on a fencing scholarship.
Flipping, right? Twinkle toes. It's very tricky fencing.
It is.
You know?
I don't like being prodded, by the way. We did fencing at school, and I'm like, I don't like that.
Yeah,
I had one lesson. I thought, no, you can bugger off with that, basically.
Right,
I didn't like it.
Wow.
So he was a really good fencer. So he was interested in biology, and he wanted to find a cure for cancer, because I think his grandmother had died from cancer, or a great-grandmother, and he was really interested in trying to be the man that, you know, that the one that helped find the cure.
Mm.
But he didn't really get on with the organic chemistry side of things.
Yeah.
Anyway, just shy. He was in his fourth year and just shy of graduating. He was singing at the same time, by the way. He was doing both. He got offered a job he just couldn't refuse. It was a job with Sunbeam Music, which was a music publishing company on Manhattan's famous Tin Pan Alley.
Wow.
And they were mostly a Broadway songs publishing company, and they wanted to get into the New York rock and roll market. And so they offered Neil an initial 16-week contract at $50 a week to write songs for their B-list artists.
Wow.
So he only had 10 credits to go, and he left school. He quit because his dream was to get one song on the radio. Isn't that funny? Do you know what? I had that too. It's really weird how you go, I just want a song played on the radio. And I can't tell you what that feels like to hear your song when you're at college. And you go, oh my God, it's on the radio. It's fantastic. So he worked at tailoring his songs to the needs and abilities of these performers. But he found the work unrewarding. And he was hanging around like 7-8 years, you know, and he said he'd be in different publishing jobs, and he'd always get sacked. He said he got sacked from so many jobs, right? And what he ended up doing, which I think is quite magnificent, he rented a storage room in a printer's shop above the famed Birdland nightclub on Broadway.
No.
Yeah, and he decided not just to like work there, he moved in. He installed a $30 piano and a pay telephone, and he set about writing his own songs his own way.
Red wine goes to my head.
UB40, Red Red Wine, from their fourth studio album and first album of covers, Labour of Love, released on the 12th of September 1983 on the Depp International and Virgin label in the UK and A&M in the USA. Mm. And it was recorded by the Manor Mobile live. Now, you wouldn't believe that. Over some overdubs. It topped the Billboard Hot 100 and the UK singles charts and was originally written, performed and recorded by Neil Diamond in 1967 and features on his second studio album, Just For You, the same album, of course, that I'm a Believer was on.
It's crazy, isn't it?
So those two songs, all I can say is ka-ching, ka-ching, ka-ching. You know, because of the songwriter.
You wouldn't realise, though. You wouldn't have thought that. I mean, you didn't know. When we were looking at it, we were both... No. In fact, I didn't know either. We were both totally surprised by the fact that Neil Diamond wrote that song.
Yeah, and the thing is that what we're trying to do is... this show is... It's kind of... You would say it was like Radio 2, middle of the road, but... If you look past some of the arrangements and stuff, the songwriting is just absolutely magnificent.
It's world class.
It's world class. I mean, at one stage, I think he said he was the world's greatest songwriter. I mean, everybody says that at some stage or other. But he is, you know, there is no doubt, though, that his structure of song, the way he creates and writes a song, a very traditional way, but and the way he uses a lyric is very, very unusual. But business was slow for a jobbing songwriter back then, as it is now. And he had time to help out in his father-in-law's haberdashery shop, where things were also slack, great word, slack, allowing him to write songs while he worked, including Red Red Wine, which he envisaged as a maudlin country ballad about drinking to forget. Blimey.
I know. So the story continues then, right? So he'd been knocking around trying to be this songwriter and this successful story and writing songs and just trying to get songs away for about 7 to 8 years, you know. And then he had a chance encounter with the songwriting record producing team of Jeff Barry and Ellie Greenwich or Greenwich. And it led to a contract with Bang Records in 1966. And he recorded his first album and it featured hit singles Solitary Man and Cherry Cherry. And he talks about Cherry Cherry actually being the one that really got him away. I think Solitary Man got him a couple of radio station plays in like, I think it was like New York or a couple of cities, but the Cherry Cherry went international as well.
Okay.
So when Neil left the Bang Records label in 68, they continued to release singles, would you believe, from his first two albums, but they often added newly recorded instruments and background vocals. So when they issued Red Red Wine as a single, they added a background choir without his permission or his involvement. Yeah. And it reminded me, it was Phil Spector, isn't it, when he did the Beatles thing?
Yeah, the Beatles, Let It Be.
Yeah. So I was like, whoa. But it only got to number 62 on the Billboard Hot 100 charts. So the song has obviously been covered by other artists as well. In 1968, there was a Dutch singer called Peter Teteru.
Blimey, sounds like something off Star Wars.
Does, doesn't it?
Tatooine, yes.
Teteru from the band T-Set.
Okay.
And they had a hit cover of the song in the Netherlands. Then in 1969, there was a Jamaican rocksteady singer called Tony Tribe, and he covered the song, but he did it in a reggae-influenced style.
Ah.
Now, he was an unknown artist, and his first release was this song on Trojan record label. And he was so unknown, and the record label got it wrong, and they actually credited his name as Tony Tripe. That's just not on, is it?
Wow.
So anyway, they recorded the single in the UK and British skinheads were obsessed with reggae at the time. Yeah. They bought the record heavily and it got to number 46 in the UK singles charts. Do you know, and I've tried to find out about Tony Tribe, but there's nothing about him on the internet. And I think he had a second single and he unfortunately got killed in a car crash. But he was one of these early reggae guys that influenced people.
Well,
so,
obviously, I mean, because UB40.
Exactly.
It was, you know, they got it from that. And they did the first record. I believe they did it in a bedroom, you know, when they did all those great singles, Ali Campbell and those guys. I mean, it was very... And UB40, for those that don't know, UB40 is the unemployment form that you fill out in the UK.
Yeah, that's right. And, the old name for it.
That's right. And when you're unemployed, what you do, you're called to sign on to the dole, which is a social security. You get money from the government.
Yeah.
And the UB40 was the actual
form that you had to fill out if you were out of work.
Yeah. So anyway.
So that was quite interesting. So When you think about it, so you've got this, you've got UB40. There was a guy called Astro, who was a member of the group. He was their former vocalist and trumpet player. They were only familiar with the reggae guy Tony Tribe's version of the song, and they didn't realise it was actually written by Neil Diamond. Blimey. Right? So, in an interview with the Financial Times, he said when they saw the writing credit was N Diamond, they thought it was a Jamaican artist called Negus Diamond.
I hope he got all the royalties from it anyway. Wow.
The unmistakable voice of Neil Diamond. And Forever in Blue Jeans. And that was from his 12th studio album, You Don't Bring Me Flowers.
Is that really what it's called, Forever in Blue Jeans? I wouldn't have thought by listening to the lyric.
I always thought it was Reverend Blue Jeans.
No.
Yeah. I didn't know it was Forever in Blue Jeans.
Well, okay.
It's Reverend Blue Jeans, yeah. And there's quite a few people on forums go, my mum used to think that. And I'm thinking, well, I'm not your mum.
No.
But yeah. It's quite a common mistake, actually. Okay. But then again, I'm not very good with lyrics, really. Anyway, so that was from his 12th studio album, You Don't Bring Me Flowers, released on the 3rd of November in 1978 on the Columbia record label. And it was also released as a single, Reverend Blue Jeans, Forever, sorry, 3 months later when it peaked at number 20 on the Billboard Hot 100 chart, and number 2 on the Easy Listening charts.
Yeah, it is pretty easy listening. But
yeah,
the problem is, after this show, I can guarantee, absolutely 100% guarantee, that you're going to be singing some of these songs. And you're going to be in bed and you're going, damn those Starlight Campbell people. They've got me singing. Yeah, it was true.
Yeah, yeah.
And but this was co-written by his guitarist, Richard Bennett, who toured Mark Knopfler and toured with everyone and his dog, Emily Harris, Vince Gill, Streisand, Steve Earle, Billy Joel, everybody. And apparently it started off as a bit of a... He'd been playing this, like, just a little bit of a lilting guitar, because at the beginning, you can hear it.
Yeah.
You can hear that guitar part as it starts.
Yeah. So Richard Bennett had been on tour with Neil from 1971... till like nearly like I think it was like 16 years was on tour with him, and they'd written five or six songs together, and this one Richard said it was a bit sort of, as you say, it's a finger picking kind of thing, and it has a bit of a dopping of the hat to Paul McCartney and Chet Atkins.
Okay.
And he was playing this tune to Neil, and Neil said, oh yeah, we should work on that. When they got into the recording studio, they cut a version of it without any lyrics, and on playback listening to it in the control room, Neil went, ah, okay, okay, this is something about Forever in Blue Jeans. And he went home that night and wrote the lyrics for it.
Well, yeah, as all great songwriters tend to do. They seem to do that, don't they?
Yeah, you just got to keep moving, though, haven't you, really, and keeping your eyes and ears open. But what I really like about Neil, the way, as I've got, I feel like he's become a little bit of a new acquaintance in my life today, just as a person, because I've known some of his music. He likes to go into writing mode, and then he likes to go into performance mode, you know? So when he's in that writing mode, he totally embraces that. And then stopping that introspective kind of thinking, analysing thing, he goes out on the road and just plays.
Yeah.
And has a great time with the audience, you know?
Well, the thing is, when I was at school... because I was away at school in Southport, and the first dormitory I was in, it was filled with, well, I say filled, I think there was sixes in there in this dorm. It's a boarding school in England, very traditional, you know. And Hot August Night, which is one of his famous, Neil Diamond's famous live albums.
Yeah.
They used to play it all the time.
Really?
Yeah, all the time in the room. And, you know, it used to actually drive me mad because, you know, bearing in mind I was only like 11 at the time. So, you know, but I was just getting into it. And then, you know, and then all of a sudden I started listening to, you know, rock and roll, you know, Led Zeppelin and all that. But this was like a very formative part of my, you know, musical development.
Love on the rocks, ain't no surprise. Just pour me a drink and I'll tell you some lies. Got nothing to lose, so you just sing the blues all the time. Gave you my heart, gave you my soul. You left me alone here with nothing to hold. Yesterday's gone, now all I want is a smile. They say they want you. What you need, you can say what you want, not much you can do when the feeling is gone. Maybe blue skies above, but it's cool when your love's on the rise. Oh, we all know the song. Love on the Rocks, it ain't no big surprise. Just pour me a drink and I'll tell you my lies. Yesterday's gone, and now all I want is a smile.
Neil Diamond, Love on the Rocks, from the soundtrack album of the film, the jazz singer released on the 19th of November 1980 on Capitol Records. Now, this is one of your favourite films. We've seen it loads of times.
I can't speak. I love this song.
Yeah, I know. And it is, you know, it's a classic tale, you know. The Jewish boy, he's there in the synagogue singing, and he does the whole thing. And eventually his father comes round after a load of stuff, meets a new woman. You know, it's all very, very heartrending. And there is nobody, and I'm going to stick my neck at it, I don't think there's anybody that does the big build-up like that. When he comes into that, you know, it is huge, you know, it's from a songwriting perspective, and it's just incredible. A beautiful, beautifully written song, you know. I mean, the production's a bit cheesy now, listen to it. There's a bit of synth in there going and all that sort of stuff when you listen to it carefully. But that kick drum when it comes in, lovely, you know. I don't know who played on this record. I've been looking around to see who played on it, but anyway, so there we are.
Which is weird, because when I was a teenager, my younger sister Laura and I, if we couldn't sleep, we'd steal downstairs, and we had a Betamax recorder. We didn't have a VHS.
No.
Because the Betamax was better.
Oh, yeah, it's a lot better quality, yeah.
But we used to watch The Jazz Singer. It was either Star Wars, Close Encounters, or The Jazz Singer. And it was one of our staple films. And it's just... And I'll tell you what it did as well. It inspired me to live my dreams, would you believe, the storyline. And I know it was a remake of an original film back, I think, with Al Johnson. It was the first lip-synced film, and it had sound. So basically, it was a silent... It heralded the end of the silent movie era, because sound was introduced with the film. 1927, Jazz Singer. So we know that. So it's a remake of that. And, well, I didn't know that, actually, until I looked at it today.
All right, okay.
So... But the actual storyline for me, it was like, okay, no matter where you come from, if music's in your heart, you've just got to follow that. And it's odd, because that's how my life has turned out, because our mantra is we go where the music takes us.
We do.
And it's odd how music brought us together. And on our journey, we've lived all over Europe. Because we go.
Already.
In the few years, you know. And so for me, it was just inspirational. And I get what you mean about the arrangement and stuff. But for me, it's like, even when you hear it in the film, when he just sits there and you can hear him in the middle of the night just starting to write the song on just a normal upright piano, just hearing it very, very raw, it works beautifully. And to me, it's like when we play an acoustic set, it's the stripped down raw versions of the songs that we play with a big four piece. And they're songs. And if they're real songs, they work.
They do.
And so for me, this song is just magnificent. Now, he wrote this, or co-wrote this, with a guy called Gilbert Bécaud.
Ah.
Who was a French chappy who was also known as Monsieur 100,000 Volts.
Why?
Oh, okay. Dear me. Yeah, for his energetic stage performances.
Right.
But apparently he'd written this, recorded Et Maintenant, which is one of the biggest selling singles in French history, translated as What Now, My Love.
Ah.
The song was a hit for Shirley Bassey, Sonny and Cher, Elvis Presley, Judy Garland, Frank Sinatra. So, major hit, yeah. So you've got this French guy writing this song with Neil. And the reason and how he got to do this film was he'd done some screen testing and somebody, it was a chap called Jerry Leader in 1976, had seen him at a concert at the Greek Theatre and asked him if he was interested in film. And he'd had a cancer scare, Neil had, in 1979, and they found a tumour on his spine and he had to have it surgically removed. So when he was confined to a wheelchair for a few months, they gave him the script for The Jazz Singer, and he got cast alongside Laurence Olivier.
No.
Yeah, who played his father.
Of course.
And Lucy Arnaz, because she came in at the last minute, actually. She was appearing on Broadway at the time, and they rewrote the character that she played to be a singer. And so the lady who was originally going to play that role with
so
him
he
anyway.
Didn't know, he didn't know that Laura Dear Lawrence was going to actually play it at all. He just got, well, all of a sudden, they just.
Well, no, they kind of knew. He said in an interview that he bumped into Dustin Hoffman, would you believe? A month before the filming was about to start. And he just said, I'm acting with Laurence Olivier, like one of the best actors in the world. What do I do? And he said, I'm a bit scared. And Dustin Hoffman was very generous to him. And he just said, look, the character in the film is scared of his dad. So just play this. Use that emotion and feed it into your character.
Wow.
Which is a beautiful thing, I thought, and very beautiful. Now, I've got a bit of an umbrage just before we move on to the next song as well, right? Because I love the jazz singer.
You do?
I bought the album twice. I've had to buy it on vinyl. Because
so you probably contributed to the 5 million sales.
Yes. But the first time, my sister Lorna scratched it.
No.
Oh, yeah. There's two things she scratched. One was my jazz singer album, and the other one was Forbidden Colors by David Sylvian and Richie Sakamoto. I had to buy that again. Anyway, so I've got this album, and I absolutely adore it, okay? Now, I did not know that apparently it was a flop at the movies, but the soundtrack was mega, mega successful. So it goes on to tell you about the fact that, you know, they have these, like, these Golden Globe Awards, or they have this kind of Raspberry Award for the worst actor, yeah, okay? Mm-hmm. So he was Neil Diamond was nominated for a Golden Globe Award that year for this film, and also, negatively, a Golden Raspberry Award, yeah, for worst actor, for the same movie, yeah?
No.
But what gets me, right, is that Laurence Olivier was also nominated for worst supporting actor. So you know what? They can all go swivel.
Where it began, I can't begin to know it, but then I know that it's growing strong. Wasn't the spring? Spring became the summer. Would have believed that you'd come along. Hand touching hand, reaching out, touching. Touching you, sweet Caroline. Good time never seemed so good. I've been inclined to believe there never was, but now. Look at the night, and it don't seem so lonely. We fill it up with only two. And when I hurt, it runs off my shoulders. How can I hurt when I'm holding you? Warm, touching wall, reaching out, see, touching me, touching you, sweet Caroline. Good time never seems so good. Thank you.
Neil Diamond and Sweet Caroline. And that was originally released as a single on the 28th of June in 1969 on the Uni MCA record label. Peaked at number 4 on the Billboard Hot 100, and 2 months later it was certified gold, having sold over 500,000 copies. And that was the live version from his 40th anniversary edition of Hot, August 9th.
Hot.
Hot. And that was originally released as a live double album in 1972. And it went huge in Australia. It was number 1 in the album charts for 29 weeks.
Well, there you are, you see. 1972. I was 14. There you go.
There you go.
So, Hot August Night.
Sweet Caroline.
And Sweet Caroline. Sweet Caroline. The other night, because currently we're in Germany, we have our studio here, and the other night we were at a local Schützenfest, which is a shooting festival, which is very big here. They don't shoot outside, they shoot for targets.
Yeah, it's very highly trained.
And these people are unbelievable. The women are unbelievable, the men are unbelievable. It's just
the skill.
The skill. Goodness me, when you see the distances they shoot. Anyway, that's another thing. But we were at this event. And when you see a whole tent full of Germans after many, many litres of beer, because they don't have steins up here. They have they drink beer.
Demurely, actually.
That's right. It's 0.2 litres
of
beer. But, of course, it's a lot stronger than British beer. It's about 5.5-6%, something like that.
Yeah.
But they fire it down like it's going out of fashion, you know?
Yeah.
And anyway, so towards the end of the night, the DJ put this on, Sweet Caroline, and the whole tent went absolutely bananas.
It did. It transformed, didn't it?
What I thought, we were playing the night after at this very festival, and yeah. I said to you, did I not?
You did.
Darling, I think we've got to play it. Now, bearing in mind, you know, Starlight Campbell Band, we're rock and rollers with, you know, all this stuff for our own material, and, you know, some people think we're pretty cool. And a lot of people would not do this because they would consider it uncool. And I thought, no, it is fantastically cool. It's not just cool, it's cool with hairy ears. And therefore we did it. And people went absolutely berserk because this song, there's a big backstory about it because people say there's the power of Sweet Caroline. And for 5 decades, it's maintained a consistent presence in pop culture, and it's been covered by everyone from Frank Sinatra, Elvis Presley, Roy Orbison, one of the greatest singers, Bob Dylan. Bob Dylan even did it.
Yeah, he sent Neil an actual copy of it, said, have a listen to this, I've covered your song.
Unbelievable. You know, and it's been in sport. In 2002, it became the anthem for the Boston Red Sox.
Yeah.
Played during the 8th innings of every game at Fenway Park. And the executive directors of that club said that it had transformative powers. And yeah. I thought it was the other night, transformative powers. I think we were a bit drunk, so. But anyway, that's what I'm saying. The Stanley Sydney Swans of the American Football League play Sweet Caroline between the third and fourth quarter of each of their home games.
The Australians, yeah.
Oh, sorry, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's been in films, Ted 2, Fever Pitch. It's been everywhere, and it is an incredible song.
And do you know what? When I started looking in that today, because, I mean, there's so much to remember, and I don't really want to get too bogged down with the notes, but at the 2017 Grammy Awards, you know James Corden does that carpool karaoke thing. We watched Paul McCartney do that, remember?
Yeah.
Well, he got that car on. He wore a car, and he got a load of, like, singers like Jennifer Lopez, and they sang Sweet Caroline.
No.
And with Neil Diamond there as well.
But there's a bit of a story about the name, how it actually came about, wasn't it? It's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, because he wrote this song. He was over in Memphis, Tennessee, baby, and he was about to record it in American Sound Studio, the legendary American Sound Studio, and he was writing a song about his then wife at the time, Marcia, and he was trying to find a word that rhymed, 3-syllable word that rhymed with Marcia. And he couldn't find it. And he was just looking around the room for inspiration. He saw this really cute girl who looked really innocent, dressed up in all her riding gear, stood next to a pony. And he just looked, he went, oh, that's beautiful, you know. And when he read her name, it was Caroline Kennedy.
No.
John F. Kennedy's daughter. And so he wrote the song about Sweet Caroline.
Girl, you'll be a woman.
so kind. You'll never get tired of putting me down, and I never know when I come around what I'm gonna find. Don't let them break up your mind.
Urge Overkill, what a great name! Girl, You'll Be a Woman Soon, from their second EP, still released in 1992 on independent label Touch and Go Records. Now, I did not know that Neil Diamond wrote this, because it's from, this version is in one of my favourite movies of all time, yeah. Pulp Fiction by Quentin Tarantino, of course.
Yep.
And I can, every time I hear it, the scene of Mia Wallace upstairs looking at Vincent as he comes in, and he's looking around and he says, make yourself a drink, I'll be down in 2 shakes of a lamb's tail. And she says that. And it's just the atmosphere. It starts to build that sexual tension between them right there. It is a perfect song. And, of course, it's on the reel-to-reel. It's on the reel-to-reel tape machine, isn't it? So yeah, so and it's just fantastic, and apparently Tarantino said that he found this record and an EP in a little record store in Holland, and he picked it up and thought, wow, what a really cool track, and it kept staying with him. So when he worked on the scene with Uma Thurman, it fitted perfectly, and of course became very iconic, like virtually every track in that movie became, you know.
Isn't that just the perfect example, though, of how you take a song and you can interpret it with different colours, different feels, you know, different spices?
Yeah.
And that's the perfect example of Neil Diamond's absolute genius, the way he can write a song. And also, these guys as well, Urge Overkill, 20 points to Gryffindor, you know, for actually taking that song and going, oh, I know how to do that. That takes imagination and vision.
Well, it does, and I love that guitar, but you can tell it's Tarantino. Like, dang, 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 dang. It's
He's
also
drawn
got
to
that
start,
little bit
he?
Of Western thing going on. That sort
tension.
Of, yeah, that sort of spaghetti Western sound, you know.
That emotion.
Wow, fantastic.
Yeah, well, so Cliff Richard has also released a cover of that, you know. I haven't heard it, though.
Well, I don't think... I've got to say, Cliff, I've got not a big problem with Cliff because he really started rock and roll, you
he
know.
He did.
We move it, you know.
It's funny, isn't it?
He really started that British
rock
and roll.
I can't quite see him that way because no. I was, you know, he was an older man by the time I was a teenager and I never, you know, you see the films, Summer Holiday, but you never kind of see him in that way.
But this was, again, was it written in 1967?
Yeah.
Again.
Released by Bang Records, and it went to number 10 in the US pop singles charts.
Wow.
This was Neil Diamond's version, yeah?
Yeah.
Because when he first recorded it, it was a slow, seductive, sensitive song. Mm. And it was for the ladies. It kind of solidified his lady fan base group, I think. And he was saying it was written for all those teenage girls who'd show up at his earliest tour dates and vocally expressed their tremendous support. That's almost a British way and not an American way of saying they just screamed.
Well, you know, I mean, you were saying earlier on in all the interviews you've seen him, because you've watched a lot about him today.
Yeah, I've had Neil Diamond Day today.
Yeah, and you were saying he's actually a very, very modest and very humble man. And I said earlier on, he said he was the greatest songwriter. Well, you know, I've heard that somewhere. I'm pretty sure I'm right. But, you know, you actually, you know, you said it doesn't sit well with him the way
he is,
you know?
No, and he was on this Larry King show for a good hour. And he's very humble. This guy's like an ex-med student, so you know he's got a level of academic of an intellect as well. But he's just saying, you know, that whenever he talks about, oh, what's your greatest experience, he just said, you know, for me it's when I'm singing and it's about us, myself and the audience, and he can only speak for himself, and you know, and he just really just loves to, he can't even quite believe that it's him, you know.
Well, he talked about his voice. He says, it's my voice is unadorned. I don't try for perfection. I try to be honest and truthful and soulful with the voice I have. If I make mistakes in notes or there are cracks in notes, I don't fix them. That's the way it is. Great.
Ellie's fine, the sun shines most of the time, and the feeling is laid back. Palm trees grow and rents are low, but you know, keep thinking about making my way back. Well, I'm New York City born and raised, but nowadays I'm lost between two shores. LA's fine, but it ain't home. New York's home, but it ain't mine no more. I am myself to no one there, and no one heard at all, not even the chair. I cried, I am, said I, and I am lost, and I can't even say why. Leaving me lonely still, did you ever read about a frog who dreamed of being a king and then became one? Well, except for the names and a few other changes, if you talk about me, the story's the same one. But I got an emptiness deep inside that I've tried, but it won't let me go. And I'm not a man who likes to swear, but I never cared for the sound of being alone. I am myself to no one there, and no one heard at all, not even the chair.
I cried. I am, said I, and I am lost, and I can't even say why. I am, I said.
Neil Diamond, I Am, I Said, released as a single on the 15th of March in 1971 on the Union record label. And he was also awarded his first Grammy Award nomination for Best Male Pop Vocal Performance.
As he should have done. Amazing, amazing voice, incredible song. It's like his version of My Way, really. Marvellous. Unfortunately, it's the end of the show. And I didn't have even time to talk about Rick Rubin or play one of the tracks from 12 songs.
Yeah.
And Every Man and His Dog was on that, and woman as well. You know, Mike Campbell from Tom Petty, everybody was on that. So anyway.
But isn't that just food for thought now? We can all go away and like start playing stuff and exploring from this show. I love that.
Oh yeah, you know, I think he's got a bad rep, but he's an amazing, amazing songwriter.
He's been undersold basically. And the main thing is, I mean, this guy is like, he sold over 100 million copies, physical copies worldwide. It goes Rolling Stones, number 7, Elton John, number 8. He's number 9 in the whole world. I mean, you know, he's even outsold Michael Jackson. Come on.
Yeah.
Elvis Presley being number 1, of course. But so thanks so much for joining us. And, you know, this, we're going to play out the show with a 4th of July standard from the film The Jazz Singer. It's America. And they say about Neil Diamond, one of his songs is like catching a wave that the audience want to catch and try and ride forever. Yeah.
country 'tis of thee,
the
sweet land of liberty,
the
of the I sing,
the
of the I sing.
Yeah.